and welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. I'm Craig Dale, I'm the Head of Policy and Research at Commonweal. The cost of living crisis is, in a very real sense, a cost of energy crisis. The UK's mismanagement of the energy sector has seen vast profits flow to energy companies and the rise in fuel poverty in our communities. Even as the crisis has started to somewhat subside, maybe, the root cause remains, and unless we do something, there will be another crisis in the future. But it has never been easier, technologically anyway, for communities to own their own means of producing energy. Community energy schemes have been shown to deliver far more in terms of local revenue and other benefits than even the most generous community benefit scheme from privately owned energy. So why don't we see more community-owned energy schemes around Scotland? My guests today are Christopher Leask from Community Energy Scotland and Josh Doble from Community Land Scotland to discuss their call for action paper, A Fair Energy Deal for Communities. Welcome to the two of you.
Afternoon. Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for the invite.
So as an introduction, Christopher, who are Community Energy Scotland and how did you get involved in this policy area?
So Community Energy Scotland is Scotland's only national charity really dedicated to supporting communities across Scotland, specifically on decarbonisation and energy projects. And we aim to sort of advance community development, strengthen their protection within Scotland, within the system as community actors, and to help them support them developing energy assets. And when I got interested in the sector and in the issue, it was really just from growing up in Orkney. We've got a wealth of community energy projects here, a track record of energy innovation through Wave and Tidal and things like that. And then on my master's in renewable energy development here at Heriot Watt's ICRT Centre in Stromness in Orkney, I was taught by Mark Hull, who is our chief technical officer and who instilled in me an interest that eventually enticed me to come work for him.
Same question to you, Josh. Who are Community Land Scotland and why is land policy so important to you?
So Community Land Scotland is the Scotland's is the representative membership body for Scotland's community landowners. So communities that own land and buildings around the country. We've got around 130 members. This ranges from some fairly large estates in the Highlands and Islands and in Dumfries and Galloway, right down to communities in the Central Belt and cities and towns around Scotland who may own assets or buildings. And we're really focused on furthering community ownership of land and buildings as a means of securing sustainable development around Scotland. And we advocate for this on a national level, and we work directly with communities to further their ambitions. And really kind of land policy, land ownership is so central for us because it's the basis of everything in Scotland. You know, if you're going to produce energy, if you're going to grow food, if you're going to build housing, any kind of development is based on the land, apart from things that take place at sea, obviously, which is a different kettle of fish. But who owns that land? Therefore, that's what gives people the potential to do that development. So in Scotland, where we have such an unequal pattern of land ownership, the opportunity to take advantage of that is extremely unfairly split. That's why we see huge amounts of wealth flowing to a small number of people and those people missing out.
So can we set the context for energy in Scotland? We know that Scotland is far from an energy poor country, but who currently owns our energy production and why do we have energy poor communities as a result?
Perhaps I could start that, Josh, and then you can add in anything that you want to. So the energy system in Scotland, it broadly reflects the global energy system in that mass decarbonisation is being led by the private sector. However, we're seeing a growing inequity in this and how communities are involved in the energy system. So from the decades-old fantastic example of community development trusts like Westry or in the Western Isles who own generating assets who are now nearing the end of their life, to the few examples of community groups in shared ownership arrangements, and then to the postcode lottery of community benefits, which themselves are not regulated or enforced. It's a very varied landscape over levels of ownership across different parts of Scotland and indeed within different communities. And I think this question is best reflected on when you start to think about energy democracy or democratising our energy system, which is a sort of core goal of CES, and I know one shared by other partner groups we've been working with. and we start to see the inequity that exists, really, we have so much more progress to make in terms of resisting that agenda of large transnational fossil fuel companies. So much more to do in terms of reclaiming our energy system for communities and for public good, and a lot more to do on restructuring energy relations to ensure that a just transition is taking place in which communities have a voice and have a sense of agency. So that, I would say, is the context of it, but also the future agenda of where we need to be heading, and that helps frame the challenges that we're currently facing.
I agree with what Christopher says. I suppose the issue is this focus on energy being delivered by private companies, and this needing to happen. Well, it is happening at a very large scale, which could often be seen as something that communities can't deliver, rather than thinking about how energy can be produced locally for more localized markets. We see very large multinational organizations developing huge sites with most of that energy not actually being for, certainly not for the Scottish market. And I suppose the only point I would add on to what Christopher was saying is that we do, you know, there is a kind of a potential for some optimism here, in that we have a very distinctive community land movement. So the potential for community energy sites, and as Christopher has said, there is an established community energy movement within Scotland, which has delivered a huge amount over the past few decades. So there's a model here that we want to see scaled up, and scaled up kind of in contrast to the more kind of corporate multinational system, which we think is just extracting wealth from Scotland rather than actually seeing this huge energy potential we have within the country feeding back into our kind of national prosperity.
What does that mean for Scotland's net zero transition if so much of our energy is currently owned by large fossil fuel companies, and so much of the transition is being driven by the same companies?
I can't speak for Christopher here, but you know, we would certainly see that that's not a just transition. You know, that's achieving net zero targets, but it's not a just transition. We're not seeing the people of Scotland benefit from that. If we look at the onshore and offshore renewable deals, that's not securing wealth for Scotland. And part of the just transition, as we understand it, is that community wealth building is at the heart of it. There is also a transition to a well-being economy. But the current energy system that we have is just kind of corporate business as usual. It's not delivering community wealth on anywhere near the scale it could be. It's not part of a well-being economy. So really, I think, you know, if we're going to start talking about a real just transition, which we speak about a lot and the government speaks about a lot, we have to think what that actually means in practice. And a just transition does not mean business as usual. It means thinking about some of these new means of economic structuring, and some of these homegrown community-based schemes which have been delivering for the last few decades and just need to be scaled up.
Totally agree with Josh there. I think what the future of the net zero transition in Scotland means is that we have an enormous opportunity, and that we have an opportunity to empower and create stronger communities across the country who can play active roles in our energy systems, and we'll all reap the benefits from that, from locally led, cost-effective delivery of government policy and objectives in often hard and expensive places to deliver policy, to, you know, more balanced and resilient energy systems, to circular energy systems, and thinking how we can work collaboratively with the private sector around refurbishment and reuse. You know, there's so many challenges and opportunities out there in this transition for us as a country, that it's really paramount that the government recognises this agenda, this opportunity, and start to really embed that within how, as a country, we're going to decarbonise.
Now, could maybe start talking about your call for action paper here, which calls specifically for community energy. Why is that important compared to, for example, campaigns for public ownership of energy at a national scale, like a national energy company? Is it specifically to address some of those challenges you just mentioned there?
I guess this relates quite directly to the whole raison d'etre of Community Energy Scotland. But what I would say in the first part of two is that, you know, across the organisations that have come together to work on this, we represent hundreds of community organisations across the country, and it's our job to represent them and fight their corner. So that's exactly what we're doing. And the benefits of community energy are so much more wide-reaching and substantial when we look at various factors, from local job creation to advancing the Fair Work agenda, health and well-being initiatives, building up local capacity and actually enhancing local decision-making and democracy, to supply chain impact and tackling depopulation and doing housing development. You know, these are just some of the impacts that community energy projects are having at local level across the country, where in communities often where the impact of that work is felt even more. And really the onus is on the UK and Scottish governments to create that higher level national structure of a public energy company and to deliver that, but that doesn't seem to be on the near horizon. So the challenge and opportunities in community energy though, and that opportunity for communities to play an active role, it's here and now and it's facing us, and we've got to start taking urgent action on that. So for us, that's why I think it's a priority, and it's what we hear day in, day out from the community groups that we represent, that they have this ambition, but they can't quite get there. And that's what we need the Scottish Government to take action on now.
I'd agree with Christopher. The only point I'd add is that, you know, I think we would welcome a more public ownership of energy, and that is absolutely coexistent with more community energy as well. I think the two actually work very nicely together. There doesn't need to be any kind of competition there. And just to reiterate what Christopher was saying, you know, we see in our membership with community landowners, when they also are community energy owners, it opens up a huge amount of door, a huge amount of possibilities. Because when the revenue generated from that renewables, it's not being extracted, it's kept within that local area. It goes into those local projects, it goes into housing projects, business development, delivering a whole range of services. And that's really kind of like community wealth building in action. So you see that kind of huge localized benefit, but then it would also be a much bigger national benefit if there was public ownership of these energy assets as well. So yeah, we would absolutely welcome governments looking into that, but at the same time encouraging community energy, and the two could work very well together.
I have to say that one of my own sort of dreams in the goals for energy policy is the public partnership, where we could have a national energy company that, for example, owns a good chunk of a large wind farm, but also the local community owns a share of it as well, perhaps a share sufficient to meet their own energy demand equivalent or something like that. But the two groups at community and national level working together.
Sorry, because I was going to say those shared, you know, that's something that we're looking at as well, is those kind of those shared ownership models, that partnership working. So yes, you know, public community, also private community or private public community. I think we need to be a little bit more expansive in terms of the type of models that might work. We're very much going just down one particular lane at the moment of like very large scale private development, but I think we're missing an opportunity if we just focus on that. Sorry, Christopher.
No, I'm just going to say that the sort of model there is akin to what's been happening in Denmark for the last 15 years, you know, since 2011, Denmark, 20% of wind farms are mandated to have community ownership. So, and they have a quasi-nationalized essentially developer. So that's exactly what you're seeing. You're seeing mass wealth building across the country in the community and public sector and public hands, which I think is a great ambition for us to have as a country, but one that we're not very near.
So to take that image of Denmark and then contrast it with Scotland, how much energy in Scotland is currently community-owned, and what are the targets set out in the call to action paper?
I could quickly run through the figures, Josh, that would help. Got them in front of me, but there are challenges in these figures in that they are only from 2022. Sorry. So the reporting on this was delayed a bit with COVID and things like that. But on the latest figures, we've got community energy a total of 908 megawatts, but here's the caveats, and this is something we're pushing Scottish Government on. Currently, community-owned energy is bundled up with community and locally-owned energy, or COLO, targets. So that 908 megawatts, if we look into the figures a bit more, we'll see that 370 megawatts of that are farm and estates, 157 megawatts are local authorities, 117 megawatts are local businesses, and only 101 megawatts of that 908 are actually wholly owned community energy, or just about 11%. And the rest is taken up by public sector, charity and housing association organisations. And these targets are very challenging for the sector, I think, in terms of how useful they are. So, for example, a recent FERA investigation found that some of the developments included as community and locally owned are in fact owned by offshore investment firms in the Caribbean. how these are either community or locally owned, I'm not sure. But you can start to see why these targets are not really fit for purpose to the point of being misleading. So in our call to action, we've called for a separate wholly owned community energy target of 1 gigawatt by 2030 in pipeline projects or delivered. And we want to work with the Scottish Government to develop that further and create a set of targets that are both fit for purpose and can help us regain our leadership internationally on community owned energy and really drive that forward.
Anything to add there, Josh?
No. Chris has covered that off from my point of view.
So what would be the benefits if some of these targets are reached and we do see more community ownership of energy? I mean, for an example, my area in South Lanarkshire's got some of the highest density of onshore wind turbines in Scotland, and it's considered quite rich in terms of the amount of community benefit funding that flows from that. I could do an entire podcast on the problems and accessing that money and using it for projects and who gets to control that and the democracy around that. In fact, that will be a good podcast for the future. I'll take a note of that. But what could it look like if we had more true community energy instead?
Josh, do you want to...
So I suppose this is a helpful point to just draw a distinction between a few of the different kind of areas that we're focused on. So on the one hand, we're talking about 100% community-owned energy that Christopher was just talking about. We're also looking into shared ownership models, like we were just talking about, you know, public community or private community deals. And then you've got the kind of community benefit model that you're probably talking about in South Lanarkshire. So we've partly put forward some ideas for how that could be reformed. You know, we think there needs to be a significant increase in the amount of money paid into community benefit funds, and also the potential to create a national community wealth fund. So you don't have this postcode lottery of some areas having access to potentially large amounts of windfall money and other areas don't have anything. So kind of creating a national fund that can be accessed by any communities that want to do a specific development. But I suppose we see those as distinct areas, and there is, to an extent, a hierarchy to them. That 100% community-owned energy is the kind of the top tier, because that means that communities are getting all of the benefits from that renewable project. They're building capacity, they're getting access to all of that revenue, they can do exactly what they want with all of that revenue, and it creates a kind of a local circular economy in which further development is possible. If we think of some of the members of the coalition that we've put together, or we think of some of our members who've got, you know, a handful of turbines, it delivers a phenomenal amount of money within that area that they can then feed into other projects. So if we reach the kind of targets that we've been talking about within the proposal, you know, we would see a significant amount of local economic and social development around Scotland, you know, far more than these community benefit funds pay out. You know, we've started to do some of the maths on this, and I won't drop anything in because some of the maths is still being figured out, but you know, we're talking about kind of like 20 times the amount of revenue, but the community also doing all of that themselves. So the capacity building, the amount of money, and the scope for development would be huge. So we'd see an absolute kind of springing to life of development opportunity around Scotland if this happened.
George, you're entirely right there, distinguishing the forms. And that's a really important part of the work we've been doing, is to raise awareness that communities have very different levels of involvement in energy development, and equally that those different levels of involvement are themselves very different in the impacts and benefits they're bringing towards communities. All I'd add was specifically on, you know, you asked what would it look like if it was more community-owned energy in South Lanarkshire versus just community benefit. And I think personally, from the work that we've been doing and from, you know, experience being here in Orkney, one of the most powerful impacts of community energy projects I've seen is the upskilling and the agency which these groups develop to then deliver transformational projects with the revenue they generate. And those skills and that sense of empowerment in communities is really priceless, and it's absolutely central to delivering this next generation of community wealth building and the whole agenda of community wealth building. And that's a long-lasting impact that you can't put a price on, I think. And besides direct financial comparisons, which Josh quite rightly points out, the revenue generated from wholly owned is significantly more. It's hard to articulate succinctly or fully that breadth of the power of communities, knowing that they can do something and they can take forward projects, and they begin to do that. And often community energy projects are the gateway to that, and where they develop these skills and learn and gain that sense of agency.
I think that's a really important point about the long-term skills, because I'm just thinking about a local proposed energy project in my area where the developers, a private company, is actually outright saying that there will be no long-term local jobs involved in this project. Maybe a few local contractors involved in the construction, but beyond that, nothing. So, yeah.
I'll just jump in quickly just to really pick up on that point and reiterate what Christopher was saying. And it's just, he's right that it's hard to kind of quantify the impact it has for a community and for the people involved in a community energy project in terms of the skills and experience that it creates. So it's not just about the money, but kind of they become, you know, substantial businesses in their own right, which are solely about raising money for that local area and feeding money back in. And so we see members, you know, take significant loans from private banks, pay them back quickly, generate a huge amount of revenue, set up new projects, new businesses. And I think the community energy sector is really the best way of answering any critics of, you know, communities not having capacity for things, not being able to do things. Well, actually, you know, we have communities all over Scotland who are doing incredibly impressive things at significant scale. And yeah, that's just something that I think, you know, we need to champion in amongst talking about the not insubstantial problems in delivering further development.
What are the barriers to getting there? How does a community that doesn't yet have any community energy start that process? But what difficulties could they face in getting there?
Perhaps I could start on that, Josh.
Yeah.
And
sure. Yeah, yeah.
So currently the developing community energy is challenging currently. See, the lack of feed-in tariffs naturally made it more challenging to make business cases. It's not impossible. We've seen members and organisations do that, make the business case, but it is inevitably more challenging. Where we're seeing significant challenges is in grid constraints. For example, our members in the Western Isles, we facilitate a group called Community Power Outer Hebrides. We also facilitate Community Power Orkney, all of which have ambitions to do further development or repowering or expansion, but are hemmed in by the lack of grid availability. And the way that the grid application system is so geared for private sector, it's technocratic, it's expensive, it's speculative, you know, and this is not conducive to community engagement at all or to facilitating community energy. And there are a whole host of barriers to community energy beside those. But what I would note is that the Scottish Government have an extremely laudable scheme called the CARE scheme, Community and Renewable Energy Scheme, which they fund and which Local Energy Scotland deliver. But even within that, there are more challenges, both financial and regulatory and planning, etc., that are still holding back community energy. So, and Scottish Government really need to now take the opportunity to work with us and double down on their ambition for community energy. It's not something tangential, it's not something small that gets out-contracted. It's a huge opportunity, not only for communities, but for government themselves to deliver their policies and their project priorities. But yeah, the barriers to actually community energy right now could be a whole podcast in itself.
Yeah, the only I agree with Christopher. The only things I'd add would be that, yeah, you know, we would call on the government to think more kind of holistically and robustly about what community energy delivers on a number of different fronts. You know, it delivers across policy sectors. It's not just about net zero or energy production, because it delivers all these other things. You know, it's got the potential to deliver on housing, rural development. You know, the list goes on, because it's economically developing these areas. And I suppose the other barrier that people probably maybe haven't touched on, but that we're certainly focused on, is the price of land and the availability of land for communities. You know, to do these projects, whatever the renewable project may be, they do need access to land for that. And if you have access to land, then you have some leverage for accessing more finance. So some means of achieving more communities having access to land would also help with this, because when communities do get access to land, one of the first things that they want to start looking into is renewable energy production.
Yeah, and of course the new land reform bill is out, and detailed discussion of that could be yet another podcast. I'm really racking up the schedule this week. But Josh, what role might the land reform bill play in helping community energy? Is there much in that bill that could help?
So potentially, I think it's probably the safest thing to say. I think the bill itself probably requires a podcast or two to get into the detail. But certainly one of the significant intervention, potentially significant interventions within the bill is this idea of lotting large-scale landholdings. So landholdings over 1,000 hectares will be looked at, and they are potentially going to be lotted and put into smaller lots with, you'd hope in theory, communities therefore more likely to be able to access a plot of land because it's going to be a smaller plot and it might be more affordable. So that does, in theory, open the door to more plots of land be available to communities on which they could do renewable projects. That being said, you know, there's a considerable amount of strengthening that needs to happen within the bill to ensure that loopholes in that lotting process are closed. We think that threshold should also be lower to 500 hectares, so you get more transactions per year, because this is only going to happen on sales or transfers. So inherited land is not going to be covered, for example. It's another loophole that we think should be closed. But there are some possibilities within the bill. It's not the kind of robust, radical bill that we hoped it might be, but there are some positive things in there that we think we can work with. And certainly this lotting, if it does end up a lotting of large estates, the breaking up of large estates into smaller parcels does open the door to communities that want to buy land and potentially develop renewable projects.
So, Chris, is there anything else from the call to action paper that you'd like to draw out that we haven't discussed?
I think we've covered the large points of it, really. What I would stress to folk is that it'd be fantastic if they go and have a look at it and see the breadth of issues that we're dealing with, and to start having a think about what can you see of these in your local community. You know, what kind of examples can you see of these? But the call to action is broad and it covers in numerous areas, and something important about it actually is, like we touched on before, is separating out these work streams into different areas. You know, we're not talking about community benefit and in all the wild senses of it, of local supply chain, you know, local jobs. We're starting to really hold government to account on the different levels of involvement that communities have in our energy system, and we need to start taking them all seriously so we can start making progress on them all. And that's in part the broad agenda of the call to action.
And I will stick a link to the call to action in the description of the podcast. Please click on it, have a read through it, and I'm sure there'll be more information in there if you want to get involved and help support the campaign. So, Christopher, Josh, thank you for coming onto the show. It's been wonderful to speak to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Craig.
And I'd just like to finish the show by reminding folk that Commonweal as an organisation is entirely funded by our donors and supporters, who give us an average of about £10 a month. We don't take government money, we don't have corporate sponsors, we don't even have adverts on our website. So if you'd like to help us with our policies, our campaigns and this podcast, please click the donate link in the description. Thank you once again to my guests. Thank you to all of my listeners. And I'll speak to you again next week.